Look, our focus is really, we've done a lot of trials. We obviously have put a lot of technology investment in because our core principle is that we want to enable customers to, charge at home or charge publicly. But equally, we want to make sure that the network is affordable to all consumers. So the really important point there is that we want to have connectivity to charging devices such that we can monitor them and really schedule the charging instances so they don't all coincide at the same point in time, which in turn would cause a significant amount of more investment than would otherwise be required. So for us, it's a real investment in technology and digital platforms, and I see that as really the new frontier of what's required in networks and energy system globally. There's a lot of the hardware like batteries and solar and everything, but the actual real complexity is how do you coordinate and manage all this to ensure that the costs are kept to a minimum, but the services significantly improved.
So is that kit, which is going to, I imagine some of it be required at household level, is it, or is all of it centralized?
Yeah, basically, if you kind of think about someone charging at home, they'll have a home charger. It's really just having a connection to that through internet or the likes that talks to our system and which is a digital platform in our control environment, and that monitors what's happening, looks at what's also happening in the surrounding network area, and then makes decisions about how best and when best to charge the car, typically from sometime, 11 at night till say 6 in the morning, but really spreading it out so it doesn't all create a peak. And in a very technical word, that's called a dynamic operating
Yeah,
envelope, and we're already doing that.
I understand
We're
it.
already,
My point is
yeah.
that part of the forthcoming infrastructure investment? Have you got a big
Oh, yeah.
infrastructure investment? What's the scale of that then in cost?
Well, so we're not investing in the smart chargers them per se, but we're investing in the digital platforms, and we've been investing in that for quite some time. Put it the other way around, if we didn't invest in this and we couldn't get that kind of thing, the cost between now and 2050, we estimate, would be an extra $3 billion worth of network investment that could be avoided if we have the digital platforms, which probably cost in the tens of millions to put in
Right.
place.
So tens of millions for that. So where's the big spending you need to upgrade the grid? Because if demand also doubles over a period of decades, as some are forecasting, what happens to the basic kit, to the power lines, and indeed not only to what they can carry, but to how they operate? How big is the investment, say, in the next 5 years on that?
Well, from the electricity distribution sector, I think, there's been reports of about 22 billion, but that's not all growth related investment. There's quite a chunk of that would be also replacement of, assets that have reached the end of their life. So 22 billion over the next 10 years is forecast in the electricity distribution sector, around 10 to 11 in generation from recollection, and around about 11 to 15 in transmission. I think the real point is, though, we continually have to search for ways to really make the utilization of the assets optimal, rather than what you would currently see pretty much anywhere around the world, where the system's designed to cater for peaks as opposed to smoothing the load out. And that's why I say the
Yeah.
real challenge is how do we get that much smarter?
Understand that. And that again comes back to the kits at various places in the network. And is that kind of smarter grid part of that 22 billion of investment that is anticipated? Okay.
Yes,
And second,
absolutely.
will it also enable a better two-way grid operation potentially?
Yes, 100%.
Okay.
You capture a great point there, Catherine. Yeah, it's about communicating both ways.
So then what is the pitch to the Commerce Commission with respect to its regulatory model? What it enables companies like yours to fund via power bills, and the particular part of the power bill that funds infrastructure. What is the scale of increase needed?
Well, for us, like over the next 5 years, I think we're anticipating around about a 20 to 30% increase in capital expenditure. How that gets funded is in a couple of different ways. One is some of it is directly funded by customers because our principle and in lines with the Electricity Authority's principles that those that cause the cost pay. So, for example, new connections that might be, connecting up a new housing development or something, they pay the cost of that. The network upgrades to cater for that growth is funded in part by customers. But the commission model looks at the capital forecast and then essentially calculates, given what they call input methodologies, what is the allowable returns. And that's where, without looking at the allowable returns, that's set by the Commerce Commission. The challenge is how does that get managed through a pricing outcome to customers?
Isn't that what you are seeking right now from the Commerce Commission, though? The ability to charge more for this purpose?
No, it's the Commerce Commission has a process which occurs once every 5 years where they reset what's known as a price path. And in that price path, they seek our capital and operating plans. They use what they call their input methodologies, which is things such as what is the allowable return on the assets, what is the level of asset investment, what's the value of the assets, and then they set a
Right.
price.
So
So
you do
it's not
not
up to them.
submit. You do not submit what you believe to be a reasonable bid. They take the
No,
data and they crunch the data, yeah?
that's right, Catherine. And what we submit is what we believe needs to occur from an investment perspective, and they crunch that data with their financial model, for want of a better word, and then they determine what is the allowable price path that we get.
What is your expectation, though, for the consumer about what's going to happen to this component of their power bill realistically?
As it stands, the consumers' power bills, lines charges represent about 27% of a power bill. There's kind of two critical functions that you're gonna take into account. So when they last set the price path, it was at a point in time of exceptionally lower interest rates. An analogy would be having a mortgage set in 2020 with interest rates extremely low, and then interest rates, when you come to reset them after 5 years, has gone up. So there's that impact. And then on top of that, we get whatever level of capital investment is required. So to round that all up, it's a determination by the Commission of on an annual basis what kind of price level increase they will allow over a 5 year
Yeah.
period. And to be honest, I would only be speculating
I'd love
as
you
to where
to.
they may end up with. Yeah.
$27, $27 on a $100 bill now. What might that look like in 5 years' time?
In 5 years' time, it could be around 35 to 40-ish, somewhere around that range.
Okay. Thank you, Simon. Let's bring in Tracy Kai. Tracy's Chief Executive of the Electricity Networks Aotearoa, which represents all 27 lines companies. Tracy, can you just explain, first of all, just explain the layout here. Not all lines companies will come under the Commerce Commission decision. Is that correct?
Yeah, 16 of our networks are regulated and 13 are not, and they all vary around the country. They have different drivers. Some are planning for population growth, others are planning for more electric vehicles, others are seeing large industry converting much of their process heat from fossil fuels to electricity. So there's variation in terms of regulation, but also what they're planning for in their regions, and they also have quite different ownership models. So it'd be fair to say that not all the EDBs are created the same. They do vary by region.
Do those smaller companies, especially the consumer-owned operators, do they have the access to finance to fund the build that is needed here?
They have access to finance. And I guess, because they are consumer-owned, there's big decisions made that involve the community and consumers about where they want to invest and how much, and also what they will charge.
This is where the pressure's going to come, isn't it? There's a massive investment needed A portion of that is going to come from consumers. The consumers won't want the power price increases. Is the model as it is now going to survive that conundrum?
Well, I think there's some hard decisions that need to be made. You either keep prices low and you don't invest in much, and that means a trade-off in potentially having less of the level of service we're used to and reliability, or you invest now and it will mean changes in prices. We've seen in other infrastructures, you know, if you don't keep up that investment, if you don't keep up the renewals, you see declines in service, you see declines in maintenance. So I think the regulatory settings actually have helped the electricity sector perform pretty well up to date. We're always in the top 10 in the world energy trilemma. However, we need to move with the times. Things are changing, and the way that consumers are wanting to consume electricity are also changing.
Part of the challenge is the EV uptake has stalled, for example, after roaring along for a while late last year. The financing involved to electrify a home, which might give you overall savings in the end, is an upfront cost, and you've only got 5 years with your bank with a reduced interest rate, and then you're up to another interest rate. So the cost pressures on households right now make that transition difficult for them. And then the question is, how much of an increase are they going to see in that power bill at the same time?
Well, I think Simon's given you a fairly good indication of at least the distribution portion increasing from, you know, if it is $100 from $27 into the probably 30 mark, hitting up to 40. But without a doubt, you know, there are pressures on all New Zealanders. But I think also the industry does a lot of good things around, you know, the Energy Mate scheme, the power credit scheme. And I think there's also things, you know, as a country, we have a winter energy payment, and that's a fund of over $500 million that the government administers. At the moment, a lot of people receive that, but it could potentially be better targeted. I think there are levers we can pull to help those that are needing the support that they need.
There's been some suggestion, Tracy, there should be custom price plans for each lines company rather than this process that's happening right now, this five-year regulatory period with a cap on spending against asset base. So we said we're talking about very different players, from the big players to the smaller companies that, in one instance I can think of, can barely struggle ever to break even. Should it be customised, especially with this big investment ahead?
I'm not sure if it should be customised, but I think it'd be a good start to understand and have access to data so we can see what's really going on the networks and how energy is being used. I think, you know, as an industry, we've been pushing really hard to have access to data.
What prevents that currently?
Well, we have many of the EDBs have ad hoc access, but it's only consumption data which is useful for planning. What we would really like to see is real-time data, and that's something we're hoping that the Electricity Authority will change in their Code 6 review.
Is that, prevented currently for privacy reasons or some other regulatory reason?
Privacy, cost, you know, there's two companies that mainly manage data. It's, you know, having access to things. And it might not mean you need customised price paths, but it might mean that we can really understand what's happening, and also consumers can get visibility of what's happening, and also they can see prices and potentially switch their behaviours and switch their uses at times where they could make savings as well.
Is the current household kit of a standard, the smart boxes of a standard to deliver that now, were the regulation to require it the barrier to go?
I think in some instances it are. I might get Simon to talk to that point.
Simon?
He's probably closer to the meter than I am.
Yeah, look, absolutely. We've got one of the highest penetrations of smart meters in the world. We have all the data coming in what's known as half-hour increments. In Australia, we run a metering business in Australia and New Zealand jointly with QIC. In Australia, they've gone to 5-minute increments of data. So We've invested materially in large-scale platforms to process and manage all that data. So yes, New Zealand is in a great position with regards to the penetration of smart meter data to get that information, as Tracy mentioned. I might also mention, Catherine, you mentioned customised price path. From my perspective, the regulation that the Commerce Commission works under is for another era. Pretty much kind of designed in the late 90s under the Bradford reforms. I think it really needs to have a look and take into account a lot more flexibility in how the capital plans are put forward, rather than locking in capital expenditure plans for 5 years. With the uncertainty of things like uptake of EVs and resilience, it'd be much better to lock in stuff which is very certain, like replacement of assets that's pretty well known over a 5 year period. But growth and EV uptake, if you lock in capital expenditure for that, that finds its way into price past the customers over the 5 year period. But it may or may not turn up, and we don't want customers paying for that. So the approach we've taken is to say, no, separate it up and have a different process for that incremental growth.
Understanding that, there's another matter with demand, and that's the data centres. I think you've got about nine you're connecting up to at the moment, and we know there's some very big players, understandably wanting to make use of New Zealand's abundant potential energy supply, renewable energy supply. But there are many people who might be asking why New Zealand consumers are paying for increased generation that then gets sucked up by data centres without a lot of additional New Zealand Inc. gain. Simon, what's the case for that?
I'd probably have a slightly different perspective. I think that if we look at the biggest consumer of energy in the country, it's the Tiwai Aluminium Smelter. It's well known that they pay materially lower than all consumers in the country. They consume about 17% of the energy in the country on average. And so for me, it's around everyone paying their fair share.
Yeah,
Most of the data centres will pay.
it's an exceptional deal, that deal, and it does provide a lot of jobs to the Southland region.
Well, I don't. I think the deal was out of date. I mean, that
Yeah,
was
but
a contract that signed a year.
you're kind of shifting it onto them. My question is now, with the demand that is coming, the computing demand that is coming, and the attractiveness of New Zealand's energy supply to international data centres, do we need to think hard about what benefit we get when we're the ones having to pay for the increase in electricity supply for the nation?
Well, I think it's, that they are paying the market price, which comes back to the point I was making around Tiwai. Everyone paying the market price, whether it's a data centre coming into the country or a, dairy factory growing. I think it's around the market price. Then how does the market price respond to the increase in demand? And we are seeing at the same time the cost of putting in new generation materially dropping globally with things like solar farms, as well as, for me, the big issue is also where do you locate generation closer to the load so you don't have to invest in big transmission upgrades. So those are all features that we see in other jurisdictions, which I think need to be very closely looked at in New Zealand. In Australia, they have things called renewable energy zones, which is really like saying where are the best locations for the generations to be set up. That means the overall lower that achieves lower overall cost than being remote from where the load is. So it's multifaceted, to be fair, Catherine.